insurance or not, particularly in psychiatry, is really stark. There are a couple of issues that come with psychiatry. So one is this issue of what they call misdiagnosis. You often find African-American people are more likely to have a more serious diagnosis being given to them. There's a whole line of research that goes into that. And so they're more likely to receive more serious medications and less likely to receive psychotherapy as an option versus sort of hardcore, heavy-duty medications. That's one big component of it. And I think a lot of that is just sort of the idea of a doctor and patient not being able to relate to each other. And I think if you can't relate and communicate to a patient well, it's always easiest to give the medication. And so that's one big part of it. I think another aspect of it is another history of African-American in the community having really sort of a fear of mental health treatment. And again, there's a bad history with how mental health treatment is stereotyped to perceive African Americans. But there's also a perception among African Americans that mental health is something that's a luxury that's afforded for white people in a way. And it sounds bad, but that's kind of how it often plays out. And there's this idea that it can be handled within the community, within church, and those sorts of things. And so there's also this sort of aversion in some ways to mental health care. So again, you have these two different things that are working together to sort of make the outcomes worse for African Americans.
And finally, how has Black Man in a White Coat been received among your colleagues in the medical community and patients?
I think really good feedback. I mean, there's certainly people, whenever you talk about race, there's some people who are always going to bristle at that. I mean, that's just inevitable. And I've had some people on the other side where they felt like I wasn't political enough and calling things out even more than I could have. So I think there's some of that, but overall my perception has been very positive. I didn't have been at Duke, so I was worried about how Duke would perceive it, because I'm still at Duke and I've been here for many years. I had an event last week and they were very enthusiastic about the event. It was well attended. People were very receptive to this message. And I think that the thing that I appreciate most is when people, I got a recent email from someone who said, you know, when I first heard about your topic in your book, I really was very reluctant. I was very wary. I kind of bristled at the idea of another person being divisive and talking about race. But then they said once they started to read it, they really understood, you know, I was able to open their eyes to something that they never knew was even something that was a problem. Like, we hear about race issues in the criminal justice system and all that, but this is a whole other world that was opening up to people. And they really appreciated my perspective. And so this is someone who may have in the first been against the whole discussion, but I was able to sort of draw them in. And so I think that's like a really positive thing that I hope to do on a larger scale.
Well, it's a real pleasure having you on Health Watch, Dr. Tweedy.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're talking today to Dr. Damon Tweedy, the author of Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
Exploring Asian American and African American relations.
Throughout most of history, Asian Americans and African Americans have not stood up with each other. We need to recognize that those instances when Asians and African Americans and other people of color have risen up together are exceptional moments in U.S. history.
Crossing East Relations, a new one-hour documentary by Dimay Roberts, Tuesday, June 6th at 11 a.m. on KBOO, Portland.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities, Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Bhargavi Davar. Bhargavi is a childhood survivor of mental institutions. She's a philosopher and psychologist and founder and director of Bapu Trust, a mental health and disability agency in Pune, India, and working throughout Asia. She's also a coordinator of INTAR, the International Network Towards Alternatives and Recovery. So, welcome to Madness Radio, Bhargavi Davar.
Hi, Will, and hi, everyone from India. This is Bhargavi from Pune.
It's great to have you on the show, Bhargavi. I've known you for some international conferences. We were at the International Hearing Voices Congress in Spain, and you're doing a lot of work in India and throughout Asia promoting peer supports and alternatives to the mental health system. So it's great to have you on the show.
I'm happy to be here after so many months after Spain, and it was lovely to meet you there.
It's very interesting to have you on the show because we know that the pharmaceutical industry and the medical model and the diagnostic and statistical manual is a global phenomenon, and there's an effort to kind of so-called modernize and really westernize other cultures. And so we're going to be talking about the situation with mental health in India and really trying to get beyond a lot of the stereotypes and the misconceptions. We tend to have a view that's either very, very negative or very, very romanticized of what is happening in Asia and India. So we're going to be talking about that. But maybe we could just begin by hearing about how you yourself got connected to and involved in the mental health system, and then how you went on to become a psychologist and to work as an advocate for change.
I spent a lot of time during my childhood years, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, roaming the old mental asylums. India, for a long time, and even now, we continue to have the old colonial type warehousing kind of institutions, you know, with the large acres of land, large buildings, the panopticon kind of invigilance with bare rooms, lockup wards, solitary confinement, the old ECT machine. We still have many of them. So my mother used to be in lockup, and when I was about 5 or 6.
She was a patient in one of these institutions?
Yeah, that's the mystery that I've tried to kind of solve through the years, you know. Was she mad, or was she spiritual? Was she in search of God? Was she bad? Was she a bad woman? I know her when very, very small, you know, as a loving mom, someone who used to dress me up in pretty clothes and do my hair and take me out and stuff like that. I have a brother too, and both of us were very attached to her. She was, you know, she was very much in prayer for most of the time. She was very creative. She could write poetry, mostly devoted to God, some of the Hindu gods that she was very fond of. And she could decorate the house and, you know, the God's room and everything for hours, and also dress herself up in ways which are considered as sacred, I would say, you know, wearing certain type of clothes, not wearing certain other types of clothes, and so on and so forth. So and sooner or later, people started seeing this as a kind of obsession, and she also then started to hear voices. She could speak to gods and goddesses. But she was, as far as I know, she wrote very coherent verses which were revered by the spiritualists in and around my household.
She wrote verses. She wrote poetry.
She was a good Sanskrit scholar. She had learned Sanskrit, and she could write poetry in Sanskrit. You know, Sanskrit is a very ancient language, and it's not easy to write poetry in Sanskrit. But over a period of time, those actions by her were just seen as some kind of madness, because it definitely took away the time that she had to give to managing the household and a very large family. We had what is called a joint family. She was expected, being the eldest daughter-in-law, she was expected to kind of be of service to the family. And she didn't have much time for that.
Because she was so interested in her spiritual pursuits, which were quite serious and quite scholarly, it sounds like.
Yeah. And she was also an artist. She could draw and paint. She was a great cook. Anyway, I think so. At some point, my family started seeing all of this as some kind of madness. And then the traditional healers came in, and then the psychiatric doctors came in, and then she was rounded up and literally tied up and taken to the local mental hospital. My childhood memories are of her being chained, you know, with iron chains, spread-eagled and iron-chained in those old, bare, cold, solitary confinement wards. And my memories from childhood are of her being given shock treatment. And if you hang around with someone, you know, with your mom, who is a voice-hearing person at the age of 4 or 5, you also end up hearing voices, you know. You could see her ghosts, and you could see her gods, and you could see the devil, you know, doing a dance around your house every night wearing red clothes, and you can see spirits walking down the stairs every night, you know. So my childhood and my brother's childhood were filled with really, really strange events, inexplicable, sometimes blissful and sometimes scary. I remember I had the most blissful dreams about God when I was very tiny. At my age, I'm 54 this year, and I'm starting to have those kinds of visions now. But I think at that time, they were all pretty scary.
When she was taken to traditional healers and then to psychiatry, were there other people in the family who were defending her? Was there anybody who was really standing up for her right to be a renouncer and to be following a spiritual path?
Not at all, you know. I'm really sad. This is the saddest part of my life. And I think, and this sadness, which has really put me into my line of work, it's a sadness, the guilt of not having seen any help coming to her, not being able to help her. You know, I was too tiny, 5 years and 6 years. My rational mind tells me that, look, you know, it was not your fault. The deepest part of me is very sad that there was no one to help her. And so I've seen lots of atrocities committed on her. You know, she would run away from the mental institution, then they would set the police after her. The police would literally tie her up in ropes and bring her home tied up. And then she would be shunted off to the mental hospital. So these are old memories, and these are really, really hard to forget. I think there was a deep connection between me and my mom when she was in prayer. I was about 4 or 5, maybe, when she was in deep prayer. She would wake up really early in the morning, say about 4 o'clock. And then she would spend a lot of time, you know, decorating the gods in her god room.
She had a god room, a special place for prayer and for her sanctuary.
Yep. We had all kinds of gods in the house. I remember one morning, there was this particular picture that she had brought home the previous night of a male god. And she was like very secretive about it. And then she said, no, you can't see it. It's too late tonight. So I'm going to show it to you tomorrow morning. I'll have everything decorated. And then you can see him. And I said, okay. And then I went off to sleep. And then at 4 o'clock, I had this really brilliant vision of this god. In full splendor, you know, and fully decorated with all the kinds of flowers that I hadn't seen, actually. But the whole God's room was decorated, and there was this particular picture, very resplendent and very brilliant, lit up and everything. So when I woke up, and my mom had not even entered the God's room at this time. It was about 4 in the morning, and she has just had a bath. And I described to her in complete detail what the picture was and how the picture was decorated. And she was shocked. And she said, you couldn't have known this because you've not seen this yet. I said, well, I saw it in my dreams. So she said that, okay, of course. And she had, of course, a very spiritual explanation why God came to me.
So in the dream, you saw the God that was in the picture that your mother had brought home, but you hadn't actually seen it yet.
Yeah. It was not like my mom to be secretive, you know. She would have just shown it to me. And it was one of those rare times when she said, no, I'm not going to show you. I'll show it to you after I'm done with it, you know. And so she was quite surprised. And she was, of course, you know, she had goosebumps because she thought that God had arrived into my life in the morning. That's how I remember my mom and our life with her. My brother had even more strange experiences. And both of us do, over a period of time, you know, carry these experiences of something strange and uncanny happening to us every now and then. I saw Jesus Christ on my garden. It was Easter morning. I was doing my gardening, and it was a very bright, sunny morning. In one shaded part of my garden, Jesus Christ shows up. It gives me this absolutely amazing, you know, endearing, embracing smile, and he's gone. So it's absolutely, it blissed me out. Yeah, it was really good.
And in those moments, do you feel a connection to your mother and her own experiences?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think so. My brother might have more of a sense of connection with her experiences of voice hearing than me, but I do have them on and off more as I grow older. I spent to complete that story, I spent a large part of my life being a complete atheist. I hated gods and I hated my mom, you know, for what this all did to me. having to live this kind of haunted life, carrying my memories around with me, making me feel quite heavy, sad.
When she was going through this, was she sort of communicating in kind of an understandable way? Would she talk about what she was going through, or was she very sort of distracted and off in her own world? Did she try and explain it or argue or defend herself when they started to say, well, look, you need to get healing, you need to go to the psychiatrist, and then eventually they took her away to the institution?
In Indian families, in Indian traditional Indian families, women don't speak out much, especially if you're the eldest daughter-in-law. So I don't think she was very understood, and her father was had passed on, you know, and she didn't have many supports from her own family, and so she didn't have much supports. She was completely dependent on my father and his large family. Her way of dissent was to get in more and more into her spiritual practice, and soon she kind of manifested like a monk. You know, she wore monk's clothes. She took off all her all the signs of marriage that women in the south of India usually wear on them, like wearing bangles and wearing a bindi, wearing certain kinds of chains and wearing certain kinds of saris in a certain way. So all those things she just shed, and she shaved her head.
And you had said that there were some scary things that you remember, some scary stories. Would you want to share those?
Throughout our life in the south of India, both my brother and I, we've carried stories of evil spirits with us, you know, in one way or the other. So we felt very strongly that there were spirits in the house where we lived as children and into adolescence. And around that, there were many scary stories, you know, strange animals, strange birds, strange behaviors of animals, strange smells, you know, strange visions. I remember one, you know, waking up one morning in my old house, opening the front door at 5 in the morning and finding 1,000 snakes all coiled one on top of each other right in front of my house. I don't know if this is a memory or if this really happened, but we lived in a snake-infested area. And so those are the things, you know, and there are many. Even when I say this story, I have goosebumps. Whether it's true or not at this point, it doesn't matter. I had so many of these, and they're all settled in my hind brain as trauma memories, and they've haunted me all these years. I've lost a life, you know, in this process. You know, I had to settle scores with my father because I was really, really upset with him for having treated my mother in an extremely bad manner, you know, constantly pushing her into the mental hospital, prohibiting us from meeting her ever. So she went and lived in a temple for many years. And when we finally went to meet her, like 10 years after she left our home.
So she had gotten out of the mental hospitals and ended up living in a spiritual temple.
Yeah, she would just run away from there. She would just run away from these institutions.
Uh-huh. Good for her.
Yeah, good for her. But the thing is, we lost complete contact with her because, you know, I think my father would have let us visit her if she was mad. But if she was in search of God, you know, then that's her fate, and we couldn't go and visit. She lived in a temple for many years, and when finally we kind of both had grown into full adults and about 20, 21, we told our dad that we want her back. And so we searched her out in an old temple somewhere in south of India. We found her in a really small, shabby room, you know, and I'll not forget, this is another of those memories. And it's one of those things that left a lingering doubt in me, which has pursued me all my life, is, you know, was she really crazy? You know, because when we entered the room, the entire wall of that room was filled with her incoherent writings. She was incoherent. She wasn't wearing much clothes on her. Her room was shabby. It was very filthy and dirty. There were things scattered all around in that room, and she was not there, you know. Her soul was not there.
Do you think it might have made a difference if she hadn't been pushed out of the family, that maybe she could have been prevented from kind of going to such an extreme incoherence?
Absolutely, absolutely. And then they started her on psychiatric medication again. And truth to tell, she did improve with those medicines. But by this time, she was completely disabled, you know, waist down. She had completely lost all motor functions. She didn't live very long after this. She passed on just after my dad. Both of them died pretty young.
So you say she did improve with the medications. What sort of improvement did you see?
Well, we could hold a conversation with her. She still continued to talk to gods. She became a local healer, by the way. We lived in an area where there were lots of construction workers and their kids who were falling sick all the time. So she would have her little herbs and little, you know, rituals, and then the children would come and then she would heal them and they were happy. And she was considered the local healer and a goddess and manifestation of a goddess. So,
do you feel it was the medications that helped her to kind of be in that role and be able to carry conversations and to interact with people? Or
yeah, I think so, that the medication she was on at the time helped her to hold coherent conversations. But I also think it was the love that was available to her in the household.
The love that was available.
Yeah, yeah. My brother and his wife took good care of her, you know. So she had Parkinson's and all the tardive dyskinesia and all the symptoms, and she died pretty young. But I think so, for 3-4 years, it gave her somewhat of a good quality of life that she may not have experienced before. So
this was a very powerful influence in your own childhood. Did you yourself start to struggle with difficult emotional states or get into conflicts or get drawn into strong spiritual practice like your mother?
Well, through most of my younger years, I was an atheist. I hated gods.
How come? Why do you think you were an atheist?
Because my house was surrounded by them. You know, I saw gods in every nook and corner. There were gods all over. It was raining gods in my house. But those memories lived with me more than the depression. I had an acute crisis when I was about 34, 35. And it took me 4 years to get out of that. It was really, really bad. I had nightmares, and I had days and days of crying, anger, breaking things. Suicidal attempts, lots and lots of thoughts of dying. I had no faith in psychiatric institutions, so I never went to meet a psychiatrist.
Was that because of what had happened to your mother?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I couldn't imagine ever visiting a psychiatrist for fear of being institutionalized. One of the things that really caused the depression was a deep spiritual crisis, for which I found an answer, you know. I lost my daughter, and that's what tripped me off. My daughter was born terribly, terribly sick, and she had complicated medical conditions, which was not even diagnosable. Every day, 24/7, she was in pain and a little closer to death every day. And I was by her side 24/7 until she died in my arms. Of course, after that, I went completely crazy. I mean, I was completely not there for 4 years. And that was the spiritual experience. That's what brought me back to my own spiritual existence. When I started thinking about life and death in a very different way. Earlier, I did not have an answer to the question, should I die? And after I went through this experience, it was like, no, life was not given to me by me. Life is precious. Life is always short. And we always wear death like a tissue around our wrist. And so what life we have is really what we make of it. So that came to me, and I made several resolutions about making the best of the time that I had with me. And this came to me, you know, when I was about 40 or so, and made some really, really drastic decisions. I moved out of my marriage. I got a divorce, you know, I cut my hair, I changed the way I dress, I changed the way I walk. I went into lots and lots of healing activities. I made a resolve to be of use to the universe.
And when did you start to become a mental health advocate and founder of the Bapu Trust?
I lost my daughter in 1994. And so 5 years later, Bapu Trust was born. Bapu's the name, in fact, of my mother. It's in dedication to my mother and her life, which for me is iconic for India and for Asia.
How do you mean that it's iconic for India and Asia?
A lot of women go through what she did. a lot of women go through what she did. And so every day we get calls. Even yesterday we had a Skype call, someone who was deviant in some way or the other. She's getting psychiatrized, getting pushed into a mental hospital. Husband is filing for divorce, not giving her alimony, taking away the kids. It's iconic. It's till today. And we are a post-colonial state. And so we have lots and lots of these laws. Where if you're a deviant woman, then to put you away in an institution and file for divorce is, you know, is really, really easy.
So deviant in the sense of becoming very religious and no longer being interested in being the role of the mother and the householder and doing the domestic work. And
not just that. Yeah, not just being a renouncer. It could be that you're not following certain stereotypes of being a woman. So it could be any deviance from the feminine stereotype. And Indian laws allow easy divorce on grounds of lunacy or unsoundness of mind. We have all those laws.
And you see these stories all the time.
Yeah, sometimes when we have the resources and when the women are close by, we go and help them out with legal assistance or other kinds of advocacy. We've run campaigns to get women out of institutions. After my daughter died, I joined the women's movement and started really understanding what gender inequality means and how to analyze social relationships in terms of structural hierarchies and power. And then the feminist movement introduced me to a lot of new concepts in activism. If you see the statistics on involuntary commitments in India, it's pretty high.
And both men and women are involuntarily committed in this way. What are some of the differences?
The difference is the extent of abuse that can happen to women inside these places. Recently, the Human Rights Watch brought out a report called Treated Worse Than Animals. They had gone inside these institutions to see how women were being treated. It's really a bad story. And they have filed a lot of petitions before different governments about institutional abuses.
What is your vision of bringing together the best in traditional cultures with some of the more modern psychologies and modern approaches? What is it that really the Bapu Trust is really pushing as a way to get away from the colonial legacy and the psychiatric perspective?
We believe that if we use words and language and logic and reason, the possibility of conflict is very high. So we can spend many hours, talking about the mental institutions and what's going on over there, and there could be different opinions and all of that. So this is one way. The other way is to be silent, cultivate the art of silence, and allow the body to respond with its different sensory capacities, and allow the body to quieten down, calm down, and heal itself. And if visions of God or visions of demons help us in our path of recovery, then that's all very fine. And so we use a lot of drumming and chanting, muttering and breathing and different kinds of breathing, involuntary movements, art and creativity, song making. So some of these we have derived actually from traditional healing systems. And so some of these principles have helped us to kind of have a more dynamic view about ourselves as people in change, and as people very much capable of rejuvenating and recovering ourselves in the moment. We do have a community mental health program which kind of applies some of the principles that I just spoke about: peace building, how to reduce conflict, how to be calm, how to build body discipline so that you're not, jumping out of your body at the moment, you're triggered by something or the other. How to hold your communications to a point where you're saying just what is objective and not what is emotional. How do you kind of have an everyday practice that will increase your stamina and endurance, and improve your fitness, your lung capacity, the amount of oxygen you take into your body? How do you change your diet? In Pune, for example, we're a small city, but Bapu Trust is one of them, which works in low-income communities. But around the city, there are a number of these, so to speak, quiet rooms. You go in there and you just be for a bit. you watch your impulses, you watch the anger coming up, you know, you figure out who you hate and you just watch that and let that emotion go. And, you know, there's lots of this kind of thing going on.
Bhargavi, we are just about out of time. Give people the contact information that they can get in touch with you and they can find out more about your work and more about the work of the Bapu Trust.
Yeah, we're at www.bapu-trust.com. It's BAPUTRUST.com. So, and another way to reach me is at my personal email ID, which is bvdavar@gmail.com. If you search for Bhargavi Davar, you will hit some of these sites.
Bhargavi Davar, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks a lot, Will. Thanks a lot for this opportunity. I very much look forward to being in touch with you.
You've been listening to an interview with Bhargavi Davar. She's a childhood survivor of mental institutions, a philosopher, and a psychologist. She's the founder and the director of the Bapu Trust, a mental health and disability agency in Pune, India, and working throughout Asia, and also a co-coordinator of INTAR, the International Network Towards Alternatives and Recovery. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
Good afternoon. It is just noon, and you are tuned in to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned now for the noontime headlines, and followed by noontime jamboree.
KBOO at the Clinton in our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. We will screen two films directed by Les Blank this month, Chulas Fronteras and Del Mero Corazon, on Thursday, June 8th at 7 p.m. Del Mero Corazon is a documentary on Chicano culture in America as it is expressed through music, focusing primarily on the Norteño sounds, featuring performances and interviews from Lil Joe and La Familia, Leo Garza, and more.